Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Episode 3 of Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life by Richard Cohen. So far I've read the preface and sort of a pre-book chapter where it just describes him going up, sets some information about him going up to Mount Fuji, and it's required me to do a little bit of research to check the questions and answers. And this next is his official chapter 1, which is really the second chapter in, and it's in a suite of chapters, being a section called The Sun Before Science. And at the front there's a Chinese archer, and the byline for it is the heroic archer Hoyu, who shot down 9 of the 10 suns, thus saving the world, and is said thereafter to have reigned over China from 2077 to 2019 BC. So that's an equal number of years before Christ. So it's a very ancient civilization, obviously. And the first chapter, chapter 1, is called Telling Stories. Now, what I've done now to make it a bit more easy, more smooth for me to read, is read through it and pick out the eye teeth of what's going on. Now, here, there's sort of several themes of different cultures having a story about the sun, why you want a story about the sun. There's a German Victorian academic who strangely finds that the Aryans are the masters of the solar myth, and in typical Victorian style, he creates a theory which encompasses everything. All words, all languages, all mythologies go back to the sun. Just a very good work. Sort of bring things together in a time before, scholarship, open scholarship. It was the idea of a single mind could contain much. And it's indeed a very prolific work. He began translating the Hindu sacred books, ancient sacred books, which were held as part of the British Empire. So he went over to Britain. There's the basic stories of the sun. So he gives the structure of our idea of stories of the sun. Then the chapter winds on and gives a really insightful little bit. It's not, I suppose, in your face expressed, and that's how there's these various myths. You have to do these rites to help the sun on its way. And the actual mythology of the sun to give explanation, but it actually gives a society a purpose. The sun actually relies on them. So the sun, rather than the rest of the cosmos, is man's creation, and man has to work at it to produce things. So sort of like this idea of how it has to be done. Then there's a story later on here about how he goes to a great South American feast or sun celebration, and it's talked about there. I don't know whether you get a real central idea about what he's trying to say. Perhaps if I read it, it's there. So there's these sort of three discordant themes. One is this German academic who sort of launched the sort of background of our understanding or acceptance of solar myths. Then there's Carl Jung, who people tend to have missed, but he's had the insight that solar myths have the function in society of giving society a purpose. And then he actually goes to our friend, what's his name, Richard Cohen, goes to a solar myth enactment in South America, where the solar mythology is still very much alive. So that's the preamble. The title of the chapter is Chapter 1, Telling Stories. And I'm going to do the podcast reverse quote, just telling you who it's from, then give you the quote, rather than you listening to the quote and going, who is it from? Maxim Muller, the 19th century Oxford professor who transformed the study of solar mythology. That's a good way of describing him. And the quote is, I look upon the sunrise and sunset, on the daily return of day and night, on the battle between light and darkness, on the whole solar drama in all its details that is acted every day, every month, every year, in heaven and in earth, as the principal subject of early mythology. So he's got, that's the main dramatic thing that happens, you can reliably say it happens. And then the next quote is by John Donne. So he's the poet. I feel a bit overrated. He wrote poems mocking death, and now he's mocking our... He's a mocking poet. I'll read it to you. Man has weaved out a net, and this net has thrown upon the heavens, and now they are his own. So... in that, one would see the net would be a net of mythology relating what happens in the heavens to their own. And quite ultimately, let's say, obviously, the planets are doing their things at own. The fact that we can actually make our lives relevant to it is sort of a great human invention. Why we'd want to do it, I don't know. Okay, reading through this, Donne's awed yet mocking lines were written in the early years of the Copernican Revolution. But they could apply just as easily to man's attempt to make sense of the heavens, to make them his own by creating stories. So the Copernican Revolution is where there's no theory of gravity, but he's saying that the planets go in perfect circles around the sun. So there's a bit of Aristotle that the heavens must be a circle, it's a perfect thing in the heavens, so there's no ellipses. So he sort of gathered that things must go around the sun, Copernicus, and by having that explanation, John Donne, an English poet, said, well, you're making up a story which we're going to explain, and Richard is saying, well, that's the purpose of general stories, to actually make a story up to make it relevant. So it's rather nice. Because all societies have myths about the sun, their sheer variety is glorious. Here it is a magician, a trickster, there a ball of fire, some figure must carry another tall canoe, a mirror, or an amazing menagerie of beasts. In Peru and northern Chile, many tribes knew the sun as the god Inuti, so it's actually a god, who descended into the ocean every evening, swam back to the east, and then reappeared, refreshed from his bath. As soon as the horse became domesticated, early in the second millennium BC, which I think, just putting it here, just looking at that's after this Chinese bloke that I read about before, the sun was portrayed as guiding a chariot drawn by four flaming steeds. So you can't have a chariot without domesticated horses, I suppose. In ancient India, these were termed Asura, Sanskrit for sun bright. The Greek word Eros shares the meaning, having evolved from the same root, sun horse. So Eros, erotic, means sun horseness. Birds are often involved, a falcon or an eagle, and of course the phoenix, which dies and is reborn from its own ashes. In Africa and India, the tiger and lion are solar animals, sunrise being represented by a young lion, noon is one in its prime, sunset is an old age. Isn't that beautiful? A lion travels across. Where lions are absent, local communities adapt. In the pre-conquest Americas, the eagle and the jaguars are chosen beasts. Well, I have to contest that. There's a lion. What else can we use? That's a fiction. Several cultures describe the sun in more than one way. Okay, so that is if you've got a page, they've got multiple, a fold of multiple ways. To the Egyptians, the solar gods numbered, so there's more than one, not only Ra, but Capri, the self-transforming one, and Harakhthi, the far one. There you go. So, I don't know how that goes. You've got one object to three gods for it. The Aztecs employed Hiutsiopochtli, the Hiutsilin hummingbird. So it's really a hummingbird to mean both the rising sun and the star at the zenith. So again, there's not a one-to-one transfix. They have something, the rising sun. So the sun is the sun rising up, and a star at the zenith is, so during the night, the stars will go from the eastern to the western horizon, and at halfway through the night, or halfway between rise and set, the sun, the star will be at its highest point. And that's what zenith means. And Tezcatlipoca, smoking or shining mirror, twilight or evening. So they've got different words for the sun at different points. So the hummingbird and then shining mirror. The sun is continually reborn, so that in all they had a jaguar sun, a wind sun, a rain of fire sun, and the god Nazuchian, full of sores, who became the fifth solar force, that of the earthquake. So I don't know quite if you understand that, that the sun is reborn, it can be reborn in different personalities. Rather a good idea. Yet whatever the form sun takes, an eye, a wing, a boat, a dragon, a fish, a bird, there is a common core, a similarity, all of these tales that spring up in cultures, often hemispheres and millennia apart. Well, I would assume so, because it's the same sun, it does the same sort of thing. Sometimes the sun is seen as so overwhelming, a threat that must be in some way tamed. In the ancient Chinese mythology, for instance, the goddess Ixchi gives birth to 10 suns, oh dear, which is rise simultaneously into the heavens, burning the harvest and all plant life by one huge mulberry bush, the Fushang, which the suns perch. Every morning the goddess bathes one of them, letting it fly up to her on the back of a crow. Yet the Mayans thought of the sun as a rattlesnake, and named their towns with an X prefix to represent the sound a snake of a snake as it sheds the old skin and, like the sun, takes on a new one. Yet whatever form the sun takes, an eye, a wing, a boat, a dragon, a fish, or a bird, there's a common core, a similarity, all these tales that springs up in cultures, often hemispheres and millennia apart. Sometimes the sun is seen as overwhelming, a threat that must in some way be tamed. In ancient Chinese mythology, for instance, the god Shai gives birth to 10 suns which rise simultaneously into the heavens, burning the harvest and all plant life by one huge mulberry bush, Fushang, on the sun's perch, in which the suns perch. Every morning the goddess bathes one of them, letting it fly up to her on the back of a crow. One day all the suns escape, and life on earth becomes unbearable. A variety of monsters scour the land. An ogre, Zorchi, with long teeth. Quying, who kills with water and fire. A giant bird that unleashes wind. Defang, the giant boar. Fingsi, and a great serpent. Zishi. The wretched people below endlessly beg the suns to come down, but they refuse. Total destruction impends until Hoyi, a young archer, slays the ogre and the monster and the giant birds, cuts the serpent in two, captures the boar, and his crowning axe shoots down 9 of the sons. Ever since the story concludes, there's only been the one last son. Sounds like a Japanese anime story. Aesop's Fables, The Sun Gets Married, has a different plot. Aesop puts the same threat. One hot summer, word comes out the sun is to marry. All the birds and beasts rejoice, especially the frogs. Until a wise old toad calls for order. My friends, he tells him, you should temper your enthusiasm, for if the sun alone dries up the marshes so that we can hardly bear it, what will become of us if he should have a dozen little sons in addition? Two stories, both teaching that one can have too much of a good thing. Almost all ancient civilizations believed the universe to have existed for unknown ages without the benefit of human intervention. The same did not hold true for the sun, which has a host of mythology, exists only by virtues of man's nature. The Hopi, northeast Arizona, for instance, claimed the sun, they made the sun by throwing up a buckskin shield along with a fox's coat, and a parrot's tail, all to make the colours of the sunrise and sunset. But whatever character it took, the sun was rarely cast as fully invulnerable. An old German custom forbade pointing at the star lest one do it harm, and it has been variously depicted as having been freed from a cave or stolen or having sprung to life through self-sacrifice of a god or a hero. Among the Inuits of the Bering Strait, all creation is attributed to the Raven Father, who is so annoyed at the man's rapacity that he hides the sun in the bag. The terrified people offered him gifts until he relents, but only to a degree, holding the sun up in the sky for a time before removing it again. There you go, that's all these interesting stories. And you've got all these taboo and fatty, Madagascar's interesting to look at. Every early society personified the cycles of nature, but where the sun is concerned, cultures differed on its gender. So cycles and the sun. In the Romance languages, the star is male, but in the Germanic, Celtic, it is feminine, and the moon is masculine. In the Upper Bavaria, the sun is still spoken of as Frau Sonn, and the moon as Hermond. For Rara Bedouin of Arabia, the sun is a mean, destructive old hag who forces the handsome moon to sleep with her for once a month, and so exhausts him that he needs another month to recover. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other groups, a month is a month. A month is the amount of time for the moon to do a complete orbit of the sun. Other groups, as the Eskimo, Cherokee, Utsi, regard the sun as female, while the Polish, the sun is neuter, the moon is male. These variations may have arisen from the climatic differences. In some areas, the day is mild and welcoming, hence the sun tends to be termed feminine, whereas the moon, ruling the chill, stern night time, is male. In equatorial regions where the daytime is searingly forbidding, the night mild and pleasant. The gender's reverse. There are exceptions. On the Malay Peninsula, the sun and the moon are both regarded as female, and the stars and the moon as children. Most creation accounts cast the sun as paramount, both over the moon and over the heavens. The book of Genesis declares, quote, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. I've never heard that, and I've had a lot of Christianity thrown at me. Gibsons refer to the sun and the moon as the two lights. Okay. The left and right eye, respectively, of Ra. But now we just go back to what the Egyptians said earlier. I'm just going to see. So there's Ra, so there's different ones. Ra, the self-transforming one, the far one. So different. Again, it's overused. Left being weaker. Left being described weaker because it's damaged. In Central and South America, amongst the Mundus of Bengal, the sun and the moon are man and wife. The Bengalis controls the sun, Siga Bonga, believing him a gentle god who does not interfere with human affairs. Another myth of the same regions fashions the stars as a man with three eyes and four arms who is abandoned by his wife because he dazzles her and wearies her. She installs cheer darkness in his place, but the sun wins her back by reducing his effulgence about to 7/8 of his original brilliance. 7/8, why is that? An interesting example of a spirit compromise making companionship possible. Many stories are told about such marital troubles, being given that the sun and the moon can never live happily together. It occurred to some of the more sophisticated ancient cultures, I don't know, I'd be weary to call one sophisticated, to wonder why, if indeed the sun is so powerful, he had to be able to abide by strict laws rather than roam at will. Surely only a slave would perform such repetitively. Numerous legends were devised to explain the thrall storm. The sun was portrayed as erratic, sometimes hurrying too fast, and other times dawdling, coming too close to the earth one moment and next moving too far away. The Spanish soldier poet Garrisquio de la Vega, one of the first bicultural Spanish Americans, tells the following story about the Huon Capac, the greatest Inca conqueror. So he's sort of half biracial, as we call him, and he's in Spanish telling a story about an Inca conqueror. Now, an Inca is the actual supreme person. So it's the great Inca. One day, this ruler stares directly into the rays of the sun, and his high priest has to remind him that their religion forbids this. Huayna Capac replies that he is king and pontiff. Is there any amongst you who would dare command me to rise and undertake a long journey? The priest answers that this is unthinkable. Huayna Capac continues, and is there any of my chieftains, no matter what his power, a worldly estate, refuse to obey me should I command him to travel to faraway Chile? The high priestess acknowledges this, no chieftain would. Then, says the Inca, so the Inca is the king, I tell you that this our father, the sun, must have a master greater than he, who thus commands him to journey across the sky day after day with never respite. Or, if he were the supreme lord, he would surely sometimes cease travelling and rest. So, I don't see how that's a way. It's an interesting thing, but it surely doesn't mean that if you've got a taboo against looking at the sun, I can't see how that necessarily works. It's also interesting to go across here. The Greeks, too, put the sun in a somewhat less than exalted position. Homer does not even grant Helos a place amongst the Olympians, nor is the sun seen as always beneficent. In the Mesopotamian myth, the solar god Nergal brings plague and war, his weapons being heat, parching winds, and lightning. Throughout history, there remains a deep ambivalence. Humanity cannot do without the sun's power, but still wishes to tame and seduce it, to limit its hold over us. What is its hold? In the latter half of the 19th century, a remarkable scholar would make the sun the focus of his research, Friedrich Max Müller. He would argue that the sun lay at the root of language, and thus all major myths, not just the obvious solar ones. So this is, as I said before, your typical Victorian person who has got the idea of personality, you know, the idea that a scientist is great, the personality is great. Müller was born in 1823 in Dressau, then the capital of a small state within the German Confederation, son of a poet. Initially, he studied Sanskrit, which kindled an interest in the philology and religion. Philology is philosophy, but not is what you believe in. He embarked on a translation of the Rig Veda, a sacred hymns of Hinduism, and in 1846 travelled to Britain to research the archives of the Indian Empire. 46, so just 23 years old, supporting himself by writing fiction, his first novel, German Love, becoming the bestseller. He stayed on, and in 1854 was appointed Professor of Modern Languages at Oxford. 14 years later, so that's 1423, he's 37, okay. He's made Professor of Comparative Philology as well, as later yet university's first Professor of Comparative Theology. The breadth of his knowledge, along with the fact that he spent years preparing a massive 50-volume English translation of the sacred books of the East, may well have made him the model of George Eliot's. So George Eliot, if it is actually a girl, doctors Casaubon, a pedant, gross, and never-ending life work, the key to all mythologies. In the novel Middlemarch, published in 1871, when Muller's reputation was at its height. In his time, the German-born Oxford academic was a truly famous figure, his friends and acquaintances spanning two generations of the British intellectual elite. Macaulay, Tennyson, Thackeray, Ruskin, I know Thackeray, Browning, Matthew, Arnold, Gladstone and Cuzon, among many others. Queen Victoria twice offered him. Okay. Queen Victoria twice offered him knighthood, which he declined as inappropriate. When he died, his widow received condolences from kings and emperors. In all, he wrote 50 books. His last words were, unsurprisingly, "I'm tired." His masterwork on the philosophy of mythology in 1871, he set about showing that the same kind of stories, the same traditions and myths, could be found worldwide, and that the appearance and disappearance of the sun and worship as the source of life were the basis of most mythological systems. From the earliest times, man constructed his understanding of the world around the sun. Quote, "What we call morning, the Aryans called the sun of the dawn. What we call noon, the evening and night. What we call spring and winter, and what we call year and time and life and eternity, all this the ancient Aryans called sun." Well, there you go. Sounds a bit, unfortunately, shades of narcissism. And yet wise people wonder and say, how curious that the ancient Aryans should have had so many solemn myths. Why, every time we say good morning, we commit a solemn myth. Every Christmas number of our newspapers, ringing out the old year and ringing in the new, is brimful of solemn myths. That's him saying, so I think he's maybe overstretching it. Over a century on, we tend to take the validity of Muller's main arguments for granted. In his own time, however, he seriously overreached, for instance, that every myth derives from the sun, as well as his emphasis on the primacy of Aryan mythology and his eagerness to converge all languages back towards a single common root, provoked a bitter battle between his camp and those who took a different path. The cause of solar pan-mythologies, that's all mythologies, lost a leading light in its death in 1900. But, though Miller's work is now known to only a few, Muller's work, he remains a major figure in their understanding of solar myths. The sun's place in the world's mythology was taken up once again in 1923 by William James Perry, who died in 49, a cultural anthropologist at the University College, London, an anatomist, Grafton Elliot Smith, who died in 55, when that year they co-authored The Children of the Sun, which argued that during mankind's early history there were groups of people on most continents who believe themselves as the progeny of a sun, which includes the Japanese, we find out. God, unrepentant heliocentrist, Perry and Smith contended that the importance of the fact in history of civilization, especially in the study of mythology and tradition, cannot be exaggerated. So, so they have a picture here, and it shows a large section of Australia believing they're children of the sun, but you can see in general most equatorial countries, from Spain, France, Germany, through Asia, Arabia, India, China, believe they're children of the sun, but not Japan. Well, there you go. Oh no, Japan believe that the emperor came down. They dated the first appearance of self-proclaimed descendants of the gods around 2580 BC, claiming that the actual progeny of Ra, the members of the pharaonic dynasties, believed that at some point the sun had come down to take the place of the king on earth, thus making them his descendants. The subjects of the king were taught never to look directly at him. Rain or sunshine were his summons. He was a master of magic and giver of the withholder of harvest. Egyptians took the divine nature of kingship further than any other society. I suppose you could say that. Although it was the Roman Emperor Vespasian who joked on his deathbed, "Damn, I think I'm turning into a god." This is a little bit confusing the way this is put. So it's not the civilization, but the actual ruling elite. Perry and Smith discerned similar belief systems among the Aurals of India, the Tamarids of Indonesia, the Arbud of San Cristobal in the Solomons, the inhabitants of many parts of Polynesia, New Zealand, although New Zealand is not marked on the map there, and East Pacific, the Inca, the Mayans, the several North American tribes, and concluded wherever it's possible to examine the ruling classes of an archaic civilization. So it's not that we're descendants, the ruling classes of an archaic civilization, it's found that they are termed gods, and they have attributes of gods, and they usually call themselves children of the sun. Like Mumbula, they finally pushed the valuable insight too far to countries where such children of the sun that held sway show up on the world atlas only in particular areas, yet they did identify a remarkable cultural pattern which enjoyed preeminence for 1,000 years. So, yeah, their map has been pushed too far, as I can see. They've got large sections of Australia, which it believes this. I don't know why they could do it. Perry and Smith then outlined the next cultural shift. As these societies thought to expand, they become more bellicose, and the children of the sun were transmogrified into war gods. For instance, the Maya broke out of Guatemala into southern Mexico. Their culture became institutionalized cruelty and aggressiveness. The same applied to the Aztecs. War, at first defensive, afterwards offensive, became a life of the tribe. They found the same secrets in Melanesia, Polynesia, and North America. Like Muller, Perry and Smith asserted that their insights held true over enormous time spans. Just as the major society so far mentioned stretched into 4,000 years, those in Al-Fari run from 320 BC until the conquest of Islam in 70 AD. China's ancient culture can be argued to run from 2800 BC until the end of the Tang Dynasty in 907 and so on. In 1925, another man who would play a key role in reimagining solar mythology and pioneer psychoanalyst Carl Jung made two journeys that together shaped his philosophy. So Jung is up with Freud, and he's sort of the central mythology of society. So whereas Freud looked at your ego and your id and your ego inside you, he Jung looked as a social mythology. And I have to work out what this all means. On his visit to the Pueblo Indians of Taos, New Mexico, a 49-year-old traveller found himself deep in conversation with one of the tribe's elders. As they sat together on the roof of his house, the old man pointed to the sun blazing overhead. "Is not he who moves there our father? Who can be another god? Nothing can be without the sun." Jung, in his turn, inquired whether the sun might not be instead a fiery ball shaped by an invisible god. My question did not arise astonishment, let alone anger, he wrote. His only reply was, the sun is God, everyone can see that. So this is the thing, is that the people don't question whether it is God. If you're in the zone, it's obviously God. What are the people who live on the roof? We are the people who live on the roof of the world, he continued. The elder. We are the sons of the Father Son, and with our religion we daily help our Father to go across the sky. We do this not only for ourselves, but for the whole world. As we were to cease practicing our religion, in 10 years the sun would no longer rise. Then it would be night forever. Jung suddenly grasped the sun myth's central role in giving the tribe a sense of meaning and purpose. So there you go, there's a second aspect to solar myths, that they actually, it's not just an explanation that you use to control others, it's you're using that to do a purpose. You're using it, you know, you're actually part of the thing that makes the crops grow. You're doing it for a purpose. His own dreams had convinced, now this is really interesting, so the explanation actually stretches back out and takes people on. I wonder whether we have got a religious belief that we believe that we're educating people for, I wonder if there's many things we believe we are doing for the purpose of society. It would fall apart if it didn't happen. I'm thinking more of just education in general. His own dreams had convinced him that human beings have an unquenchable longing for light, and a trip he took to Africa several months later to investigate the myths of the mountain people dwelling between the Mombasa and Nairobi bore out his theory. So he had his dreams and he interpreted his own dreams. There he watched as they waited each day for the birth of the sun, and every morning, as they explained, the moment when the sun appears is God. So it's not a thing, but it's a time, is God. For Jung, this daily celebration of the sun, in place so far away from the pueblo in Taos, confirmed the universality of the primal longing, even if the Africans, unlike the pueblo, saw the sun as a means of creating light, not the supreme being. So, yeah, they had that light, that the sun is, yeah, it's interesting. So they're celebrating the instant of light coming, the God is arriving. So for several decades after Jung's journey, scant organized research was conducted in the religious practice of pre-literate peoples. But in 1958, the great Romanian historian of religion, Misira Ialdi, 1907-86, to issue with all the heliocentric ideas that had been put forward, arguing that the sun was simply one of the commonplaces of which is a vague sense of religious experience, and that the in agrarian societies that followed the ancient hunter-gatherer cultures, in which farmers had already become dependent on changes of the seasons for their crops, and especially on warmth and light, the solar deity turned from a god into a fecundator. So it's not just a god, it's actually something which does a function, I suppose. His special word, fecundator. For all the innumerable myths, Eliade wrote, only certain cultures, the Egyptians and many Indo-Europeans and Mesoamerican civilizations, had developed a true solar religions. It seems to me, though, Eliot was building on Jung's insights, not negating them, and that so many cultures continued for hundreds, sometimes thousands of years to hold on to myths of solar supremacy shows that such stories were central to their sense of self, and also tells us something about the sun's enduring hold over mankind. Just in what way, I decided to see for myself. So there's ancient myths, then there's the theories of myths, and now he's going to practice enlightened myth he's read about. So he's now read about myths and the theories of myths, and now he's going on his own myth quest. In June 2004, the year before Fuji, I set out for Peru to witness Initi Raymi, an ancient festival that honours the Incas' summer solstice. It takes place in Cuzco, over 2 miles up the Andes, and opens in the northeastern quadrant of the city square. By the time I arrived, the skies had opened, a cloudburst was hammering down, and the crowds, red, blue, and yellow, green, plastic rain, were almost equal the vividness of the actors playing the pages of the long-slain Inca court, troops of orange-clad court virgins, and the Inca soldiery, Peruvian regulars, seconded for the occasion. So the Peruvian army's up there, and the royal cortege, all in its splendor. After about half an hour, we moved to some 300 yards to the Corcacha, a square of gold, where the messages sounded conscious to placate the Apu Ini, the sun god, and the Wali Kwoma, high priest, intoned exhortations in Quechua, the Indian language still spoken by some 20% of the Peruvians. The woman next to me explained the local actors had been practicing for a month. Her husband, a jeweler, was playing one of the attendant priests. The high priest, acolyte, was busy munching gum. Okay. So he's up there and he's chewing gum. The third and final part of the day events was held a short bus journey away to Sasquama, pronounced sexy woman, but meaning satiated eagle. So they just hop on buses. That's how weird. You've got this thing, they're wearing plastic raincoats, they're practicing, they're chatting, but they're catching buses. That's a bit weird, isn't it? Where a range of huge joint stone formed an almost important Inca monument after Machu Picchu. The sheer size of it. So Machu Picchu still stands, a stone column called, this is a footnote, Initu Harada, meaning hitching post of the sun, or literally for tying the sun. The ceremony to tie up the sun was to prevent it from escaping. The Spanish conquest never found Machu Picchu, but it destroyed all other hitching posts, so ending the practice. Wow, a hitching post for the sun, what a great idea. Remarkable. Somewhere as much as 90 towns between 1533 and 1621, when the Spanish were there. Oh, okay. They were rolled on tree trunks greased with Vanica oil from a quarry. Well, the actual rocks were from the quarry. The oil's probably not from a quarry. Over half a mile away, and arranged into the form of a huge twisting snake. A mighty presence of the old religion, yet somehow permitted by the Spanish. Every 5 meters, the blocks have been cut either male or female, with prominences or sockets accordingly to fit together tightly that I couldn't get a sharp blade between them. This great wall formed the backdrop of the main celebration. So it's actually a relatively recent thing. It's like visiting Anak, or these modern places around the place, which are mock Victorian or mock old. Our group guide, Odilia, a small, well-organized woman. Hopefully her arms and eyes are in the right place. In her late 40s, mentioned that when she was a child, her grandmother, now 94, had told her that behind the stones lay a great earthen hill where once stood a palace and 3 astronomical observatories. Sure enough, in 87, so we know this is true, all 4 were discovered. Today, excavations are going on all the time, and some 328 stones used for the solstice celebrations have already been found. Okay, Adelia next taught us how to pray to the sun, leaning forward slightly, not so much out of reference, but to present the softest part of one's head to the great orb above. She removed her shoes and stretched out her arms, fingers displayed, to help her body be in touch with the sun and the earth, the two great sources of life. I wandered away from my group to be swept up by the hundreds of locals, women and ancient... So she's in a Kentucky tour. Women and ancient in traditional costumes, men rigged out in conquistas and matadors or draped in nothing but leopard skins. Boys, no girls, sounding trumpets, conches and cymbals, strumming guitars and banging on drums. The sounds will be just complete chaos. Vendors were offering everything from ubiquitous tapestries of pumas and llamas to hats, cocoa teas, finger puppets, postcards, sodas, sweets, ice, city flags, ponchos, film equipment, chess sets. And so it's just a tourist shindig as far as I can see. There was still a fine drizzle, so the gaudy plastic covers were being brought in numbers. Amid the clamour, many were dancing, including an impossibly ancient crone who spun around as energetically as Wilfred's a third of her age. In one corner, just off the main festival precinct, there bustled a travelling fair, complete with sides and merry-go-rounds. Jugglers and street artists performed their acts every few yards. Sweaters, necklaces and brooches in every imaginable style were being hawked, and chicken bubbled in huge black swerving pots, bubbled, tended by women in bright shawls, beads and hats. The smells of guinea pigs, pork, corn, cob and vegetable. I wonder what a guinea pig is. That's roasted guinea pig. I think he just had to put the word guinea pig in there. I can't smell corn. I suppose you can do it. And the various unable concoctions hung thick in the afternoon air. At an ice cream stand, a woman vigorously stirred a huge bowl of vanilla. What? The crowd was raucous, good-natured. This was their day. The ceremony began at 2 p.m., on the Great Plateau, a large rectangular stage had been constructed, with curtains painted to look like stones. Highland Indians from four corners of the ancient empire trotted to join their leader, who was poised to drink a sacred chicha made from fermented corn. Some 500 locals took part, roared on by an audience of 40,000. Wow, that's big. That's big for that stage. That's a big football. That's a huge number. Fires burst out at each corners of the plateau. One nearest us spluttered fitfully and kept having to be reignited. The conches were sounded yet again, yet more frenetically. The basic ceremony was much like a Christian communion service, with girls decked out and Inca princess offering up baskets of sacred bread while trying to restrain their gills. The blazing colours of their costumes took one's breath away. No Inca virgin had her heart ripped out to unveil the future. However, as was essential before the conquest, even the llama sacrifice was play-acted. The animal eventually set free to the tail. So the interesting thing is that they believed that the heart's energy, the sun's energy was in the heart, and getting the heart was liberating the energy back to the sun. Okay, something of genuine depth seemed to be asserting itself behind the commercial gloss. The pride in the log conquered in their enduring ways, even the sense of the star itself. If no longer divine, then it was still a very special power. To crown it all, just as the drizzle dried away, the sun came out and the rainbow magically appeared. I counted its colours, recalling Byron 200 years ago. Oh, this is a bit sad, because you've got to be in the mood. Byron wasn't there. A heavenly chameleon, an airy child of vapour and sun, brought forth a purple cradle and vermilion, baptised them all in gold and swathed in dun. The sun god, it seemed, had heard our prayers, and the solstice had duly honoured. As I walked away from the sacrifice, the sacred field, I wondered how anyone could doubt the sun's control over us. In some essential sense, it is still a prime organising principle of our lives. So essentially, it's solar theories, some basic solar theories, and then people making over arching things. There's Muller who had the Aryan myths. There's other groups who said, who made the idea that ruling classes used the sun legend to give themselves authority, which is an interesting thing. The people were gods, so if the sun could come down, they could mate with the ruling class and give them great powers. And we're on to this chapter 2. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.